You're listening to another episode of Our Delaware Valley. I'm your host, Marcus Goldman. And with me again today is a fellow who's been on quite a few times to talk about the different aspects of Philadelphia, whether they be haunted, whether they be just the bizarre historical facts and the bizarre historical information about this area. And due to the fact that we have the love holiday coming up, we are going to talk about Valentine's Day and the interesting and rich history along with it. My guest is Joseph Woji, who is the owner of Grim Tours here in Philly, and he is here to talk about all that is St. Valentine's Day. Welcome, Joe.
Thank you for having me on, Marcus. Good to see you again.
It's good to see you again as well, and I'm excited to talk about some of this decadent stuff.
Hell yeah.
So that we can get a better feel for what St. Valentine's Day is and how it started.
Well, you got to figure that people were interested in love and romance and all of that stuff since the dawn of time. I mean, hey, if we didn't have sex, if we didn't have romance, if we didn't have love, we wouldn't have people. We have to procreate. We're, you know, kind of hardwired to do that. And the ancient peoples were looking into this stuff, you know, as far as soulmates and you know, things to lure people in. It was something that people across cultures always thought about. I mean, Valentine's Day, it's nothing new, really.
Interesting, because the idea of romance for many people is more of a Victorian concept than I think many of our views on romance are more Victorian and modern than really looking at some of the ancient aspects.
Well, a lot of the things that we get today come from the Victorian period, but they were a little bit more conservative than the pagans and everything like they came before them. You know, the white wedding dresses and the manners, the proper behavior and reserving yourself, virginity, all that stuff, man. It's totally Victorian. But if you look at what people were doing way before that, they were a lot more free. You know, the church kind of reels back on that. And then Queen Victoria sets a lot of examples for people loved her. So whatever she did, whatever she said, people really took it to heart.
Yeah, she was well respected and well loved as far as royalty goes. And usually people don't have such a kind or loving view of royalty if you are of the lower class.
That is true. The lower classes liked her, though, and she was a trendsetter for sure. But if you look at like Valentine's Day, so around the Victorian period, like you said, you know, we start to have like Cadbury boxes and things that are, you know, for lovers to
roses.
Give one another. Chocolate had only just begun to be able to be, I think a Swiss or a Dutch chemist, it was, figured it out how to make them into solids. They weren't even in solid form until the 1800s, actually, and they were super expensive, man. Chocolate houses were trendy, expensive places. They were known as aphrodisiacs, so that's like the perfect thing to give your lover, right? Because you want to get her in the mood and give her some expensive thing to put her in the mood.
That's interesting because cacao powder, which they use to make chocolate, was used as a drug for ancient cultures. They would snort it to sort of use it as an upper, like a coca plant or something like that back in those days as well. So how they evolved the cacao to a solid form of chocolate is pretty fascinating.
And European palates were a little bit more sensitive to the idea of some sugar being in there, because if you taste cacao, like straight cacao, it's really bitter. But Montezuma, you know, speaking of that, because chocolate comes from Mexico, he used to drink 50 to 60 cups of that a day. He had 600 wives, you know, to keep up with, but it was like their, you know, Aztec Viagra, you know, so to speak. Very bitter. Well, the Spanish put in it like honey or vanilla. That was the first thing before they got a hold of sugar to put
in. The processed form of sugar. Isn't sugar more Caribbean and Central American as well, as far as cane root goes?
Yeah, I mean, it's indigenous to Asia, but we popularized it once the New World was discovered. It was by and large really grown, yeah, in the Caribbean, exactly.
Let's talk about who this St. Valentine is, this guy or this person or even this lady. We're not really sure. Who is St. Valentine? And how did they develop this holiday after a Saint Valentine?
Well, we've got the church stepping in on things, right? So what they were doing is seeking to really kind of quarantine what the pagans were doing before this. You got to figure, like, there's continuity and stuff, because the ancient Romans were celebrating a fertility festival called Lupercalia, and it was like a sex lottery, man. It was just like drinking and sex and orgy. It was 3 days right at Valentine, well, what we consider Valentine, because it would have been the 13th, 14th, and 15th of February, which is a little bit warmer in Italy. It gets a little warmer a little sooner, so that's like the spring, birds and the bees. babies, you want to procreate. Very important for the Romans to procreate. And the Saint Valentine idea that is formulated by the church is to get people to stop having this like festival of sex and blood and goat's milk and sacrifice and all of these pagan things that people thought were really cool. It was probably their second most important or loved holiday of the year behind Saturnalia, from which we get the Christmas experience that we have today. But they martyred a couple of different guys, or two in the third century, one in the fourth century, that were named Valentines. We don't have a specific Saint Valentine. There's three different guys, and they were marrying people that were in the Roman army, and it was against the law. They had really harsh punishments back then, a lot of which was just death. You stole things, you were killed, so you didn't do it again.
Yeah, you looked at somebody funny, death.
And that's what the Romans did. And there were a couple of guys. I mean, there were more people than just these Valentine guys, but they were marrying guys that were in the army and they weren't allowed to. And it was punishable by death, but they did it in the name of love. And the church was like, that's totally awesome, right? Like, but let's, you know, replace all of this crazy orgy stuff and drinking wine with this Saint Valentine. But it didn't really catch on, because you got to figure Lupercalia. Oh my God. I mean, just to be a fly on the wall or be able to go back in time and to see this stuff, you would have the Lupercai, right? The brothers of the wolf. It's a whole thing is in honor of Lupa, the she-wolf who raised Romulus and Remus, the founders of Rome. Like, in other words, if you want to say you're badass, just be like, yo man, I was raised by wolves, you know? Like
I'm Romulus. Lupercal kid.
like Romulus and Remus. And so it's in honor of her. And it's a fertility festival, so everybody goes up and is naked. Every participant takes their, you're all fully naked, and you sacrifice a couple of goats and a dog, and you tear up the hides, and everybody, it's like grab ass locker room fun, smacks each other with the things, you drink a lot of wine, you dip them in goat's milk first, and everybody, the source on this is Plutarch, you know, it's totally legit stuff. They run down the middle of the streets. If you look at, like, in Philly, we have the ride bicycle,
the naked bike ride.
Yeah, it'll be like that with sex and wine and spilling out in the streets. It would be off the hook. The biggest sex party of the year, and the Romans were known for their orgies, and you didn't have to necessarily be married to the person that you got, you know, picked for you as the partner that you would have for the next 3 days, but you could hang out and you could do it every year and you could get another person picked. The women would put their names basically on shards of, it would go into a big piece of pottery and it would put their names on like little shards of pottery that would go into the big vessel. And then the men would all form a line and the priest, the Lupercai, would draw the name of a woman. And then that would be your partner. Everybody would cheer, and you'd be paired up with somebody that you would spend the 3 days with. You could get to know them pretty well.
Yeah,
you could spend a lot more time with them after the festival. But it was 3 days of really like just debauchery and fun and drinking and sex. And sex was important. Just as a one last thing, the Romans had this as so important because they had such a low birth rate for a couple of different reasons. One of it being they mistook brain fluid, semen, they thought was brain fluid. And so they thought that if they it made them dumb. I guess somebody must have bashed someone's brains out and been like, oh, I know what that is, you know, at some point. And they thought that it made them stupid. So they tried not to. So in other words, their birth rate actually went down. So this was
so it wasn't lead in the wine. It was these other weird things versus lead in the wine.
Well, there would be lead, in the silverware.
I was taught about the lead in the wine, but something weird like this makes more sense.
Well, they were the first society actually that commoners even got one, which is pretty cool. But yeah, the lead in the, like the silverware. Well, it would be leadware. You know, they'd be the utensils. That obviously isn't healthy.
Yeah, obviously.
For us in any way.
I'm sure they had lead and paints back then as well.
And some crazy, crazy practices.
Yeah, they did. It's, again, fascinating how a pagan ceremony evolved into this Christian ceremony of the same name, but totally took on a different meaning. And I was actually going to ask you if during the 3 days of Lupercalia, they had multiple partners, like, hey, it's Monday, I'm going to have one partner, Tuesday, a new partner, and Wednesday, the third day, I'm going to have a third partner. Or
you generally like had one. You had the one partner for the continuity of the festival. They were into orgies. Orgies were more of a thing of the upper class, but during this festival, anybody could participate. And so you would wind up having more of like the upper class doing their own thing separate from common people. They wouldn't mingle and have sex with common people. I mean, they did.
Yeah.
They were remarkably cosmopolitan and forward-looking like we are today. And I mean, they were really similar to us because they would divorce, man, they'd have stepkids, they'd remarry, they'd marry, and they were the ones to make common the wedding ring, which is actually an Egyptian Egyptian thing.
Really?
But the Romans thought it was really cool. And so they copied it. And basically, we get this from them. Like, we wear wedding rings on the finger that we do. The Romans called it the vena amoris. It's the one vein in that finger that goes directly to the heart. And that's why they chose that finger to do it on. The Egyptians, they were really about fidelity, though. And so you would lose that finger if you cheated. And so if you didn't bleed out, everybody would see, like, ooh, you're unfaithful in love. Like, it was that important to the Egyptians.
Whoa.
They felt like, as opposed to the Greeks who, like, you know, I think, therefore I am. You know, I think, like, with my brain, the Egyptians were like, nah, man, it's our heart that's weighed at the end of time against the feather of Moth, the feather of truth. And so the heart is the seat of the personality. And that vein in that finger goes straight to the heart. Love was super cool and important to the Egyptians. And the Romans thought that was awesome. And they picked that up. They popularized. It was pretty cool.
Interesting about the fidelity aspect of Egypt versus the decadence of the Greeks and the Romans, because Cleopatra, who probably was a European, and they think Armenian queen, if I'm not mistaken,
right, like Macedonian.
Or Macedonian or
yeah,
Armenian,
yeah.
One of those. So she wasn't truly Egyptian from what they're saying, but...
Oh, and she spoke seven
languages. And she banged J.C. and Mark Antony,
yep,
and a bunch of other leaders. She slept with all these strategically slept with all these other leaders around the world. So if she was married and practicing that, you know, that aspect, it doesn't make sense. It shows the hypocrisy of the elite.
There's definitely an hypocrisy. I mean, because you got to figure, like, you know, Julius Caesar's wife is Calpurnia, and she's like back home, and he's shacked up with Cleopatra. And then once he dies, she's like, wow, all right, let me find the next best bet on the most powerful guy that there is. It's either going to be Octavian or Mark Antony. And if I were her, I would have bet on Mark Antony too. But they truly fell in love. He was married, of course,
yeah,
too.
Of course.
But they truly fell in love, and he wanted to be with her. It's like one of the most awesome love stories in true life of all time.
Romeo and Juliet,
it's,
in a lot of ways.
In a lot of ways, because then it winds up being, because Mark Antony is married to his sort of partner who he's sharing power with, Octavian.
Yes.
He's married to his sister. So, like, it totally causes a war, because dude's like, my God, you're, like, off cheating with this foreign chick, and you're married to my sister. It was just a little extra fuel for him. He was probably going to go to war with them anyway, but that's definitely, like, the straw that broke the camel's back. They went to war and they lost. Antony and Cleopatra. But it's a love story between them, for sure.
And I wonder if it was modified by Shakespeare in some ways, because there's some similarities from what it seems like as far as just some little basics. Interesting. But yeah, the history of that area and how it evolved to modern-day Valentine's Day is fascinating. And again, I think earlier we discussed the Victorian aspect of it, which is where it's evolved. Now, how did the marketing take hold, and when did the marketing aspect or capitalist aspect of the holiday take power, like the card aspect and the gift aspect?
In England. It starts in England, and it starts in Victorian times too. And it's Cadbury makes the first box of chocolates, and then it winds up going crazier and crazier from there. And today, God, we spend billions of dollars. North America is the biggest consumer of chocolates in particular, but when you look at the amount of money people spend on Valentine's Day, it only goes behind Christmas in spending. And people
more than Halloween.
It's more than Halloween.
Ooh.
We spend money on, everybody goes to restaurants, nice restaurants. They go away for a nice little weekend.
That's true.
You gotta, you know, the marketing dollars that are spent on this, it's astronomical. North America actually is the biggest spender. We spend
There's no doubt.
But there's more Europeans, and we spend more. It's important to Europeans, but it's important to us too. And all over the place, because if you look at, like, in Japan, for example, they have like two Valentine's Days.
What?
This is what they did over there to market it. They have a month later what they call White Day. And it's like totally role reversal. Chicks give the guys the chocolates. And you might get chocolates from like six or nine different girls. And you decide who to give your affections back to a month later. And the crazier part about it is that there's all this aspect of blood magic over there. There's blood
magic in Japan.
And
is
it's all
like
over.
Modern day Japan Valentine's Day?
Modern day Japan. Women will give chocolates that they've made themselves, and they'll put some of their own blood or hair or saliva for magic to work, it's got to have a little piece of either the person that is doing the spell or the person that is to be affected. The women are putting their blood in it, and there's recipes for this, and it says to put some raspberry puree in it. It'll cover the taste and texture up.
But in different aspects of the history, putting blood or bodily fluid into your stuff has always been part of the love recipe, whether it be voodoo, whether it be European witch, whether it be American witch, whatever the culture, shaman. You need parts of people's soul or
and
their
the
body.
Voodoo stuff is fascinating too. You got to look at like the stuff that the voodoo practitioners do with these love potions. This is stuff that starts in Africa, in like Ghana, Nigeria, comes over with enslaved peoples way back, and it mixes together with Native American shamanism. And so peppers are always a thing that's supposed to be aphrodisiac.
Capsaicin in the heat, which is weird because a lot of people don't like spice, but...
But it's supposed to get the blood flowing. It opens up the, so that you have more oxygen in the veins and everything.
It does all that. It's a healing. There's a healing aspect to the capsaicin and the peppers as well.
Marie Laveau would famously, down in New Orleans, she would make these love potions, and they would have, obviously, some blood. They would have the hot peppers. The Native Americans believed that the hot peppers were an aphrodisiac as well as the chocolates, and they would worship, actually, like the chocolate trees and everything, the cacao trees down. The Mayans would do that in the Yucatan Peninsula. But when it comes up here with like Marie Laveau, she was very famous for having sold a lot of this stuff. I mean, she did it obviously for money, and that's why she's so famous and supposed to have lived for over 100 years, supposedly. Well, she had a daughter also named Marie Laveau. So they think that, you know, basically people kind of mix those together and get all confused with which one was the mom, which one was the daughter, who did what when.
You mentioned the fact that the spicy chocolates of the Native Americans, the peppers and the chocolates, we act like that spicy pepper chocolate or that cayenne chocolate is a big deal when it's been done for thousands and thousands of years. In the wintertime, the Native Americans drank the cayenne and the hot cacao in
and
a liquid form.
It tastes lovely, too.
Oh, it is so good. And you do. You warm up. You know how, like, wine warms your cheeks when you drink it?
Absolutely.
You get that feeling from the cayenne and the hot chocolate mix as well.
Oh, my gosh.
On a cold day. You know exactly what I'm talking
about.
It's
wonderful.
Oh, it really is. And I can see where the aphrodisiac aspect rolls in. It's fascinating how it started with Cadbury chocolates and things like that. But then when did the greeting cards and the roses and like all of that aspect?
Well,
is
again,
that more
England.
Of a North American thing, or is that still an English thing?
It started in England
and it comes
over here. But to go more into the aspect of these aphrodisiacs, every culture around the world had this stuff. Back in the Bible, it says figs are supposed to be from the goddess Aphrodite. And so she's the goddess of love, beauty, and everything else. And on the other coin, the Romans called that same goddess Venus. And we have the diseases of the goddess Venus, venereal diseases, unfortunately, come with that as well. But that was something unknown to Native Americans here until Europeans brought it over. But some of the other aphrodisiacs...
Was that because of the Europeans and their love for animals on lonely
it was
cold
not,
nights? I'm
it
curious.
Was the, it was the Spanish the, love for
Because the Native Americans would have killed their own for having sex with animals. That was a no-no in Native American culture. Like, they would have been kicked out of the
tribe. Yeah, Native Americans were...
They had a
they
lot
were,
more honor.
They were free with sex in a lot of ways. I can't speak for every Native American culture, but I know during the Lewis and Clark expedition, when they went across the country, they were very free with their women and would share them with others. And they thought that power would rub off during the act of sex. And so to get the power of, you know, these Europeans who had guns and you know, technologies and things like that that were seen as powerful, they would inadvertently get that power rubbed off on them through their wives having sex with them, because they didn't practice homosexuality, at least in North America. I can't speak for the others.
But they still respected five different sexes of humans. Right. And did you also know that in the early days of the church, they married homosexual couples?
I've read something about that.
I've got a really good book that I've read two chapters into, and it's one of those that you don't just read all the way through. You read a chapter here, put it down, read other things, read a chapter here. And just because it's textbook tedious. And
right.
It's written like a
gotcha.
Textbook.
Gotcha.
Yeah, they talk about that aspect. And it's weird because, like, you have the Greeks who were very bisexual as a culture.
Yeah.
The Romans kind of straightened up except for the elites. And then you had the Christians, but they were either very heterosexual romantic love or celibate, depending on which branch of the Christian tree you fell off of.
Closeted.
Or closeted. Yeah. And the ones that were celibate were usually closeted homosexuals because they were different and they had to be fixed by the Lord.
And it was punishable by death as well. So that was a big aspect.
So all these different aspects of the culture are, you know, this is how they practice. But again, we both have read that they were marrying homosexual couples back then. So with Valentine's Day and the holiday, was it intentionally designed for romantic love between man and woman?
It was designed as just fertility. It wasn't romantic love that kind of enters, it evolves into that. Because we think of that today.
Fertility is romantic love. That's, we kind of, we mix those up.
Yeah, and to speak, because I mentioned with North America and homosexuality, a lot of the ancient peoples were not hung up on that. Like you said, you know, the Greeks, you know, Alexander the Great, you know, much more homosexual than he was anything else. Hercules and Perseus.
They were totally.
Before Disney kind of tweaks that stuff, you know, for modern audiences back, you know, in the 50s. No, man, they were, you know, they were definitely homosexual. They had different sort of ideas about things way back in the day. And if you read into some of the texts too, like the Kama Sutra, you know, this is written by a sage in 150 AD, Mullananga Vatsyayana. No problem with homosexuality. None whatsoever. You do what pleases you. And as far as, you know, I mean, it's a guidebook to virtuous living. You know, he says, you know, you need to educate yourself and you need to establish yourself as somebody that's honorable, that people would want to be friends with, that people would want to be a lover of. And homosexuality is absolutely just fine. And women should be treated as equals. This is unheard of for a guy 2,000 years ago.
That's over 2,000 years ago. What?
Nobody 2,000 years ago was thinking like this, as forward as that. It's pretty cool. It's remarkable.
That's interesting. Wow. I'm going to have to actually read the Kama Sutra now.
It's 95% just kind of how to live very virtuously. Yeah. It's everybody gets hung up on the fact that there's like 64 sexual positions that are described pretty in much in detail.
And that's what they describe as, that's to most people what the whole Kama Sutra is, those 64 sex positions.
Right.
The fact that we are getting so hung up on so many things when we should be able to live free, I don't care what anybody does as long as they're happy. And you should be happy and you have a right to be happy and you have a right to have sexual relations with the person that makes you happy. There should be no constrictions in society or nobody governing that for anybody else. I don't care.
And the Greeks, as a matter of fact, when they talked about soulmates, now the Kama Sutra doesn't buy into the idea of soulmates. The Greeks did.
It's weird because they're very into the soul with the Hindu religion, so how?
But the Greeks did, they explained that your soulmate could be, if you're a man, it could be another man. You could have these different relationships. This is how they explained it in the form of mythology. They said, we are all the children of the moon, sun, and stars. And we used to be like two people kind of merged in one, two women together, two men together, and a man and a woman together. And the gods, for our transgressions, punished us and sliced us in half and scattered us to the wind. And we've ever since been on a search to find that perfect soulmate, because we have one perfect soulmate that's out there. And that's why some men seek out other men, women seek out other women, or men and women seek out one another. And it's based on this, at least they explain a lot of things via these stories that are mythology, you know, that were their religion back then. You know, we say mythology. To them, it was something that they really believed. But back to the Kama Sutra, and what Mullananga said was that any number of men and women, or, you know, anybody could be happy enough with somebody else. You might not be happy with just anybody, but there could be a handful of people for any man or any woman that's out there. And as long as you have, the number one thing is respect and confidence, inspire confidence in one another, respect one another, have an almost painfully long courtship. And this is like 2,000 years ago when there were no painfully long courtships.
Yeah.
You know, just get married and then don't even have sex right away. Just, there needs to be confidence. There needs to be trust. Your partners for the rest of your lives, there needs to be that ultimate respect and trust and honoring one another. It's pretty cool.
That is very cool.
For a 2,000-year-old guy, this man was, he was onto something.
So in our day, you seal the deal with marriage by having sex with that person you marry.
The consummation.
The consummation of the marriage is having sex. What was the consummation of the marriage in the Kama Sutra to confirm that partnership the way the consummation does?
Well, it wasn't the consummation that actually confirmed the partnership. It was the marriage ceremony itself. And like a lot of other cultures too, like we were talking about the color white for virginity and for purity.
Hebrew culture, it's very big in ancient Hebrew culture.
Well,
the virgin and the red sheet, hanging it up to make sure she's a virgin so that everybody at the wedding could see afterwards.
They would do that in all these European matches. But the color of marriage in a lot of other cultures, in India, in China, it's red. Red's the color of passion, man. It's the color of passion and blood, actually, you know. And
That's where passion is. Passion's the blood.
It's a fine line, too, if you think about the line between love and hate. They're the most extreme passions that we have. And, you know, how quick to be really terrible, actually, to the person that you love the most in spurts when you're fighting, you know, can we be? There's a fine line that's kind of there. It's very passionate. And then it could, you know, jump into like makeup sex and all that stuff,
yeah,
too.
Makeup sex. I'm sure that's something that's been going on as long as human beings have been human beings.
Lots with the Romans, I'm sure, because didn't have any sort of civil or religious ceremonies to be married. They just decided, hey, you want to be married, and then they could break up. They just looked at each other in the eyes. One of them had to just say, I divorce you in front of one other witness, and they're divorced. But you could get all drunk and just apologize the next day, I had too much wine,
and then
can
be married again.
Please forgive me, be my wife again, and bam, you're remarried. So you could break up, and however, you know,
that's
tempestuous
hilarious.
A relationship is, you could break up and be married 50 times, you know, however many times that we could do it. Today, break up with a boyfriend or a girlfriend.
That's exactly how it is today. We're going steady, then we break up, and then the next day we're back together. Oh, I'm so sorry, I love you so much, I would never break up again, and then, yeah.
Over
that's totally hilarious that we're repeating these old things in a different way.
Yeah, it repeats itself. History does what the Romans said. But some of the other things that they would believe, the Romans as well as other people, was, you know, you are what you eat. And so with the aphrodisiacs, a lot of the aphrodisiacs, when you look at different cultures, wind up being like the phallus of an animal. Or dangerous stuff, too. The
pufferfish.
That as well, which could kill you.
Yeah, if you eat the wrong piece.
And you've got cobra venom and
cobra
blood.
They have the cobra liqueur in India that's supposed to be pretty good, and then when you drink it, it numbs your mouth and your face. Yeah, they have like a cobra venom
the
liqueur.
FDA does not appreciate that over in the United States. Unfortunately, we cannot get that here.
But I've seen people bring it in.
Well, if they take the wormwood out, I think it's legal now.
It is legal now, but
I think it originated. I think wormwood originated in like northern Italy, if I'm not mistaken. But
maybe Germany because of the Jaeger. And
it's not what Van Gogh drank, though.
Getting back to St. Valentine's Day and the culture aspect, is it safe to say that we are taking these ancient cultures' ideas and modifying them to make them our own pretty much over and over, just repeating history in a different way?
I think subconsciously we may be. In some ways, at least, anyway.
It feels like it. And, you know, again, Valentine's Day, because it's funny you mentioned the Japanese holiday where a month later, the white holiday, where it's a reversal, because the U.S. guys joke about it being steak and job day. It's 1 month after Valentine's Day. And I wonder if they got that. Somebody started calling it that based on the two Valentine's Day in Japan, which is the reversal, which is pretty interesting. And okay, so now here we go, the St. Valentine's Day Massacre. What is it?
It was just gangsters. It happened to be on St. Valentine's Day. So some guys didn't get to go home to their sweethearts that night.
Is there anything else we need to talk about as far as Valentine's Day goes, or anything we missed, or anything we didn't cover?
Well, we didn't cover a little bit of the chocolates.
Let's talk a little bit more about the chocolate.
Back to the origins of it, right? The cacao beans were actually used as money down in Mesoamerica. And so like one could buy you a tamale, a hunter could buy you a turkey hen or a slave. They would use this stuff in their rituals of birth, marriage, and death when they did human sacrifice, which they had on the largest level in the world of any culture that has sacrificed humans. The Aztecs did it every single night. It was to ensure that the sun rose again, and they would give the cacao in a drinkable form to the sacrificial victims, who would be ensuring that the rest of the world would live and that they should be happy, that they would have their still beating hearts cut out of their chest with an obsidian knife. And in some of them, you know, were like, oh my God, they they'd be treated like a king for the whole day before their hearts were cut out. But then when it came time to get their hearts cut out, someone would have a crisis of conscience and be like, oh my God, you know what, man, maybe Hitzacuatl is just totally a lie. Maybe the gods don't exist. Maybe if I didn't get my heart cut out, I wouldn't actually be dooming all of mankind, and the sun would just rise again, you know. So that was when they started actually to give them the cacao, because it was like drinking the money. It was so expensive. And they'd be like, oh man, cheer up, here, yeah, have have some cocoa, you know. But it's an interesting thing to think about, though, for
sure.
That
is pretty fascinating.
And Casanova, it was so expensive. Like, by the time it got over to Italy, he was such a prick. He would just eat it himself. He wouldn't even share it with the girls. He would eat it himself to get himself in a mood. And then he would go over to the girls.
What a jerk.
Totally, totally.
That's hilarious.
It's a good story, I suppose.
That is a great story. You know. Again, with me is Joseph Woji of Grim Philly Tours here in Philadelphia, as well as Stockton University, to talk about the wonderful holiday that we love to celebrate, St. Valentine's Day, February 14th. And now we know a little bit more about it. Where can people get more information about Grim Philly Tours, about your St. Valentine's Day tours? And do you want to do a quick talk about those tours that you give around the Valentine's Day holidays?
Sure, absolutely. Well, you can go to grimphilly.com. That's 1M, like the Grim Reaper. We do a lot of ghost tours and things like that in the fall and other parts of the year, too. But we do an awesome Christmas tour, and we do this great Valentine Tavern tour of blood, sex, and magic. We talk about a lot of this stuff over drink. We give you a little drink demonstration with a mixology portion that's an alcohol education thing behind the bar. We give you guys some alcoholic kind of elixirs of the 1920s, as well as some aphrodisiacs, and we talk, and it's pretty cool. It's good for lovers, good for friends. Bachelorette parties have booked this like crazy, and you know, people come out with just friends. They come out, it's a great date night, and you learn really cool, interesting things, you know, and you get to hang out. So another one of the things, you can add this in as well. If you think about the wedding ring, and you think about our primal urges, right? With wedding rings, with a woman wearing big diamonds and things like that, psychologists say, because if you look at it, like if there was a zombie apocalypse, you know, mm-hmm. just face it, you'd rather have a pack of matches than like a $10,000 diamond.
You don't need a diamond. What's the diamond going to get you? Oh, I'm going to cut the zombie.
Yeah, it's worth the value that we decide to put on it, right? So psychologists, what they say is it's kind of like the primal urges that we have in fighting over the female of the species, you know, yeah. peacocks or, you know, whatever other birds or lions that are fighting. And so the woman is the discerning one that decides who they want. And we beat each other off in order to get to her. But we don't do that anymore. Like, we're not running around beating each other up necessarily. But it's the way in the modern world for a woman to say, like, well, look at this humongous thing on my finger, you know, look at what completely extreme and useless lengths that he has actually gone to for me, you know, because I'm totally worth it and I made him do this, and that's why I chose him, you know. A part of the reason, it's a lot of chemistry though too, and people say chemistry, and so modern, you know, medical science has kind of isolated some of the things that cause sexual attraction and that cause people to be together and have this whole, like, they call it the cuddle hormone.
Yeah.
It's the oxytocin. Women more have oxytocin. We have it too. Men have it as well. But men have a little bit more dopamine. Androsterone also is the steroid that's released. It's the pheromone that's released from our bodies that actually attract women and attract men. And this is why they put that in some of the perfumes and cologne, you know, so it's like faking them out, you know, like, oh, I have sexual prowess because I have this. I have the right perfume. I have the right cologne to wear.
I'm glad that you mentioned that because, yes, smell, I think, is one of those things that people really use as an attractive but don't realize it. I think that's the sensory perception that we don't realize the most is the smell of somebody.
It's unconscious, it seems.
I think it's almost much more unconscious. And then when you realize things are going, you're like, hey, I really like the smell of that person, you know, from a chemistry standpoint.
I don't know if it was the Arabs that figured it out, but they were the first ones to actually use distillation. And so distillation was something that they concocted alcohol from.
Mm-hmm.
And also they would pull the essence out of flowers, out of rose petals. They would take like 10,000 pounds of rose petals and get like, I don't know, 100 ounces of essence from it. And I think today, still, like 75% of perfumes, they're based on what they pull out of roses. And then you add your own sort of touch on it if you're this, that, or the other perfume company for whatever brand it is.
Fascinating. Again, with me is Joseph Woji. He is from Grim Philly Tours. He's here to talk about Valentine's Day, this holiday that we know and love so dearly. Do you want to give out your website, your social media information again?
Yeah, it's grimphilly.com, 856-829-3100. info@grimphilly.com. Grim is spelled with one M, like the Grim Reaper. So grimphilly.com. Check us out. We've got a lot of different things, and it's usually R-rated professors doing stuff. You have some tours with drinks, some tours with history, some tours with both, and we have a lot of fun.
And all the information's at your website as far as which tours are available and which ones are 21 plus and which ones are family.
Everything. Yeah, most of them are 14 and up, most of the tours, unless there's drinking.
And we'll get you back sometime around either Easter or the 4th of July, and we'll talk about maybe the 4th of July around Philly and back what happened 200 years ago and why we do what we do on the 4th of July.
That sounds perfect.
All righty. Thanks very much, Joseph.
Thanks for having me on, Marcus.
You're listening to another episode of Our Delaware Valley. I'm your host, Marcus Goldman. If you would like more information about Grim Philly or anything Our Delaware Valley related, all you got to do is email me, marcus.goldman@bbgi.com. Thank you very much for listening. Enjoy your Sunday.
BackstageCountry.com, your online home for all things country music. Like most fans of country music, we're excited to learn that Luke Combs was back in the studio working on his next album. We've come up with our list of iconic Luke Combs music videos. Yes, Lovin' On You made the cut. Text Luke to 45911 to see if your favorite made the list on BackstageCountry.com. Text Luke to 45911 and we'll send the link straight to your phone.